This week, we welcome Ted Driggs, head of product, and Ben Higgins, distinguished software engineer from ExtraHop, to make the case for supply chain behavior transparency. In the leadership and communication section, what is the hidden cost of maintaining legacy systems? 10 leadership habits of highly effective leaders. 5 key ingredients to finding satisfaction and fulfillment in your work, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week. Cybercriminals are using social engineering, loaded with urgency and fear, to successfully prey on victims, your employees, or your customers. Protect your Office 365 email from today's most sophisticated attacks with Barracuda Email Threat Scanner. It's a free tool to help protect your business from these hard-to-detect attacks. The Barracuda Email Threat Scanner uses artificial intelligence to hunt and eliminate Office 365 email threats. Find the cybersecurity threats hiding in your Office 365 email right now. Get your free email threat scan at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. We're proud to announce CISO Stories, a new podcast series in partnership with Cybersecurity Collaborative and Cyber Reason. CISO Stories features the candid perspectives and experiences of frontline senior security executives and dives deep into timely security topics. CISO Stories is hosted by Todd Fitzgerald, VP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Cybersecurity Collaborative, and Sam Curry, Chief Product and Security Officer at Cyber Reason. Listen weekly as they speak with extraordinary CISOs by visiting securityweekly.com/CSP.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 221, recorded June 21st, 2021. I am your host, Matt Alderman, back in Colorado after a quick little trip to Texas. Maybe more on that later. Joining me remotely are my two co-hosts today. First, Mr. Jason Albuquerque. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, Matt. How you doing? Remote, obviously, today. Spent my weekend on a soccer field on Father's Day. Oh. So, 4 soccer games. For my kids' tournament. It was good, though. It was good. I got a little sun.
Yeah. Usually I would be at baseball games, except for my son graduated, and there's nowhere baseball for him. Unless he does it at Texas Tech. We'll see.
There you go.
My second co-host, also joining remotely, Adrian Sanabria. Welcome, Adrian.
Hey, thanks, Matt. I had a great Father's Day. Spent it with my kids and parents, and I think first time we've gotten together without masks. And so it was pretty nice. We spent it in a park, but in the shade. So I didn't get nearly as much sun as Jason.
Yeah, it's cloudy and rainy in Colorado today. So it's kind of weird. I went from heat to it's cold outside. It was weird. Security Weekly is excited to announce that Security Weekly Unlocked will be held in person. Yes, in person, live, this December 5th through 8th at the Hilton Lake Buena Vista. Call for presentations and early registration for Security Weekly listeners is open now. Visit securityweekly.com/unlock to submit your presentation and register for the early registration price before it expires. Join us June 24th at 11 a.m. Eastern to learn how web application firewalls can help mitigate exposure in a complex threat landscape. Then join us on July 15th at 11 a.m. Eastern to learn how a thoughtful approach to SASE can improve security and enable scalability. Visit securityweekly.com/webcast to register now. If you've missed any of our previously recorded webcasts or technical trainings, they are available for your viewing pleasure at securityweekly.com/on demand. This segment is sponsored by ExtraHop. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. Ted Driggs is a seasoned and customer-focused product manager with a background in enterprise IT, community building, and cloud-native security. Ben Higgins is a distinguished software engineer at ExtraHop with 15 years of experience in cybersecurity. He has extensive experience in systems engineering and protocol parsing, fingerprinting, and encryption. Ted, Ben, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Likewise. Thanks, Matt.
All right. So we're going to talk about behavior transparency. And to start this, I think, though, we should start with kind of the basics, right? The reason we're talking about this is the new kind of cyber directive mandates this thing called the Software Bill of Materials, which is a starting point to understanding your supply chain, what software is included in different aspects of your applications and your supply chain. But it doesn't go necessarily far enough. So before we get into behavior transparency and why, let's start with just a backup a little bit on an overview of the Software Bill of Materials, why it's a good starting point, but doesn't necessarily go far enough.
Sure thing. So the Software Bill of Materials is really focused on what's in the software that runs in your environment, right? What libraries does it include? What other binaries does it include? What tools were used to build it? And the idea is to be able to track if there is a vulnerability or something upstream, how does that flow down through the system? And that is really important for risk management and for procurement time decisions, but it doesn't help as much with understanding whether a particular behavior in an environment is malicious or benign.
Right. And I think that's the real crux of SolarWinds, right? Is that in that particular case, there was a code injected in that broke the supply chain. The Software Bill of Materials may or may not have picked that up. It depends on how automated the SBOM creation is, right? It would have been signed by SolarWinds, so it would have looked legit. But what it was doing was actually malicious. And without that understanding of what that software was doing, we never would have known whether it was good or bad.
Right. The attackers there took advantage of the asymmetry that SolarWinds wouldn't know the runtime behaviors of their software in other people's environments if it deviated from the expectation, and that the defenders would not know or have easy access to the SolarWinds published list of behaviors that were network behaviors specifically that were expected for this software. So SolarWinds did publish, these are the domains that our software will contact, and this the ASVSM cloud was not on that list. But finding that list, especially as a blue team person who has to investigate tons of threats every day, was too much time and energy on one thing that at first glance appeared benign. Indeed, if you looked at the payload that was sent, it wasn't clear that this was malicious. They went to great lengths to disguise it as real product telemetry.
Right. So, and just to add to that, one, I think, starting point with what we're calling behavior transparency is to just take a very small step from what a lot of vendors do already today. So, a lot of companies will publish external connection information in particular that their products perform. And they do that for security teams, in particular firewall teams, that might need to open up, modify their firewalls config to allow that connection. The problem with that model is that it doesn't really scale very well. Today, we have that information spread across web pages and maybe in PDFs and other collateral. It's hard to track it down across all of the products that you might use. And it's also not very easily machine readable. So a couple of the key points in behavior transparency are to create a more standardized machine readable format for these behaviors, and also to establish a clearinghouse where you can more easily discover this list.
Right. And I wanted to go into the behavior transparency because one of the things you guys mentioned when we were building this is it's not meant to be like a disclosure component. I mean, what we're trying to get here is transparency around how a piece of software should behave such that I can baseline it to a point where if something deviates out of that baseline, it is something that potentially is malicious and therefore I should investigate. But for 80% of the cases, maybe you don't even have to look at it, right? And so let's start with what does a behavior transparency baseline look like? Outside of machine readable and outside of domains, what other things should we think about that should be included in this behavior transparency baseline?
So a very concrete example of this is something that Microsoft did a really phenomenal job of documenting, but looked an awful lot like an attacker performing reconnaissance in a network. So Defender Identity Protection did some scanning of the network in a way that looked an awful lot like this attacker trying to find their next pivot point. If under behavior transparency, that piece of software documented that it did those sorts of scans on those ports, any security product that observed that behavior would be able to go, okay, I see enough evidence that this is running Defender Identity Protection and that covers this behavior. So now when if I surface this to the analyst at all, I can surface it with a note that this is very plausibly Defender behavior, and they can safely discard the alert if they know that Defender is present on that system. So a big part of the benefit here is the ability to short circuit research that the Defender needs to do, and sidestepping the sensitivity about sharing data about security incidents, because these are the publicly documented behaviors that the software already performs.
Right. Now, what about things like that you can or maybe can't detect again? So we talked about processes, for example, right? That's something that the endpoint potentially would see, knowing that that is a legitimate or an illegitimate process that's running. So not only does it include network behavior, it could also include process or endpoint level behavior as well.
Right. One of the big advantages of having a centralized clearinghouse for this compared to some of the in-band or decentralized alternatives for bill of materials distribution or threat intel distribution is it's very easy to pick up and version the entire database in that situation. So adding new behavior types is something that we've definitely discussed. And while we focused so far on network behaviors, because that's where the need is greatest, the idea of extending this to endpoint behaviors is certainly very possible. And if the endpoint detection community is interested, something that we'd love to engage with them on.
Yeah. Before I consume this entire interview, I want to give Adrian and Jason a chance to come in.
Yeah,
here.
No, I was looking for a spot to jump in, and believe me, I fully support, you know, us evolving, you know, our standards to have requirements for behavior transparency, creating the clearinghouse. But I always step back and I say, you know, we're going to be dealing with the federal government and federal government mandates here, and I just want to say that I would love it to be a public-private partnership to set up these standards and not something that's driven from the federal government down, because the success of our teams and our ability to actually utilize this information effectively and this data effectively is really going to be dependent on us getting involved as professionals in the industry, right? So, you know, I love the concept. I love where we're going with this. How do I get on a board to be able to make sure we're influencing the government to do the right thing, right? Because we all see regulation that can become overbearing. And that's the last thing we want. We want this to be value add across the industry.
Yeah, I mean, Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I feel like there's two parts of this. You know, there's the part where, you know, and defenders can figure this out on their own. You know, it's just going to take them more time to monitor what that software is doing and, you know, determine what those normal behaviors are, create a baseline. You know, but even if the vendor does hand them those network behaviors and things like that, and it's fairly commonplace to at least get the ports that you have to open on like a host-based firewall or network-based firewall. From the vendor, but obviously this goes a bit beyond that. But you still have to implement them. You know, I think that's somewhere, you know, where, again, to Jason's point, you know, we need some standardization here, where we can easily, you know, maybe the vendor can share a file and we can easily plug that into a product, and that product knows, oh, okay, you know, anywhere SolarWinds is installed, you know, this is the only stuff outbound we should see from that, and anything differing from that, either block it outright or generate an alert off of that.
Right. So getting adoption and getting the incremental buy-in on this are two things that we've thought quite a lot about, because those are the cruxes of what makes this succeed or fail. One of the things we've identified is that we need to enable and foster community contribution to these databases so that vendors are not being asked out of the gate to do extra work, especially work that doesn't fit as well with static tooling on top of any bill of materials work that's required by the government. So what we focused on there is the incremental improvement of start by detecting or alerting, and then in the future, as these get more complete, then move towards actual enforcement of this data. We recognize that it, automatic blocking lasts until your first big outage caused by overeager blocking, and that's when the any rules start to come back in. So we've really been focusing more on describe, reduce the attack surface by steadily filtering out the stuff that can't hide. And then if this gets traction, that's when, for say a firewall vendor, this gets really compelling of, hey, now I can do automatic blocking based on these behavior transparency documents.
We all learned from our early days of intrusion prevention and how you create an outage very quickly.
Yes.
Yep.
I think it's a really, it is really a key question of how do we sort of prime the pump to sort of build up the demand for this type of information. But I think that there really are a lot of potential consumers of it. In addition to firewalls and NDR tools, I could see like just going to your SIM and saying, show me all external network connections from these machines, but you know, remove that known good baseline of this list of software that I know is installed on it, and just let me see everything else. So I think the way that the community might contribute, again, like vendors publish a lot of this information already. And so that in combination with, you know, direct observation of a bunch of software products, I think could help produce sort of the initial set of some of this behavior transparency documents.
It's also important to think about for the vendors who we are asking to consume data like this, how do they add value or differentiate? Because this otherwise risks becoming something that vendors ignore the database and attempt to build in parallel. So what we've been focusing on are the documented behaviors of these softwares, but that leaves a lot of room for organizations to apply machine learning or to build experiences around the facts from this database that would be unique or compelling. So a product might choose to enrich a particular connection by saying, hey, we've searched the behavior transparency database, and this could be one of these three pieces of software that did this, or there are no matches. Or somebody might score particular behaviors from the database to say, these are the common behaviors for this software. So even though these 10 are documented, these four are the ones that we normally see. And the rarity across the entire industry of this particular documented behavior might suggest that somebody has either turned on a weird setting that you should check up on, or is doing something strange within the bounds of what this software is documented as able to do.
And, you know, if you approach it the other direction, kind of, you know, I think you could easily build a library of stuff that should be extremely rare, that shouldn't happen very often at all. Like there's not many legitimate, you know, IT products, security products that should be dumping passwords from memory, that should be doing mimi cats like behaviors, right?
Right. Network behaviors have been harder for making that statement so far than endpoint behaviors, partially due to the difficulty in even figuring out what's doing that, right? With processes on the endpoint, it can be easier to figure out, to trace that back to the initial spawning process or the initial file that, you know, started that execution. And from the network perspective, that can be very difficult to figure out. So some of the most serious attacks that we see on the wire look completely legitimate. And it's only with the benefit of context that we understand that that device is not the backup domain controller. It might have the right credentials, it might have all the right pieces, but until this morning, it was running Spotify in Office and had one user log into it for 6 months. That is a laptop. That is not a domain controller.
Right. So detect and alert, kind of the first phase to build adoption. Integration into endpoint process and other capabilities extends that. So where do we start with the format. I think that's the other big thing. Like, how do you start to rally around a way to express this behavior data in a more standardized format? And then where do you store it? Like, where's the repository? How do you start to think about those couple pieces to gain adoption from the outside to start to add this data, right, in a standardized format or close standardized? And then where do you put it?
Ben, do you want to take this one? Because you came up with a pretty brilliantly...
Well, it's pretty... Just to try to keep it simple, I mean, it could just be a GitHub repo, right? And there's this sort of pretty well-known mechanism these days called code owners file, where you can say anytime there's a change made to any of these files in this folder, put me on the review list. So just using GitHub and a code owners file, vendors could register that, you know, these are our products and we need to be in the loop on any changes made here. And you know, as far as the format itself, like we've been saying, we're not trying to be exhaustive by any means right out of the gate. We're really trying to get that 80% expressiveness that can capture, again, you know, what vendors are already publishing today in regard to external connections. And as far as getting vendors to be involved here, another thing I just want to mention about that is if it's really in their best interest too, because if you were a supply chain attacker, you'd probably want to try to target a vendor that maybe wasn't on board with something like this or didn't pay as close attention, because the folks that do publish this type of information probably are more likely to have customers that will consume it, care about it, and notice when things are amiss. And even if there was a successful supply chain attack carried out on one of their customers, it will be caught by, hopefully caught by the community faster. And even though it would still be, you know, embarrassing or bad news, it wouldn't be as bad as it might have been otherwise. So I really think it's kind of, I really think it's a win-win both for vendors. They're already publishing a lot of this information already. I think vendors should want to have their customers looking at this closely. And of course, it is still kind of a big problem of, like, even if there is all this information, how do we also get people to effectively leverage it? But again, I really hope that there'd actually be a wide variety of tools and products that could potentially consume it.
I mean, yeah, so in order to make this successful, I see that we need three or so different things, right? Number one, we need that support from a federal government perspective, regulation or executive order, that level of support. But it also is going to require coordination and collaboration, right? Some federal agency or some community agency needs to own this, right? Needs to actually own the strategy, own keeping the initiative up to date and relevant, and then collaboration between industry, collaboration between the federal or community partner that's actually managing this to be able to take feedback. Because I think community feedback is going to be a very important piece to making this successful as well, right? So who do you, in your Nirvana scenario, who do you see actually being that central authority who would manage the accountability and responsibility for making sure this is successful? Is this a CISA role? Is this a NIST role? Where do you guys see this living and being managed?
So we've had good conversations about this with a number of organizations, and I don't know that we want to put any one organization on the spot by naming them as, hey, we'd like them to take this on. But any of the even just industry-led standards groups would be more than sufficient for this. The regulatory aspect is something that we're not sure is required for this to be successful. And we've been designing around let's make sure that incremental adoption will provide immediate value, right? Mm-hmm. Making one of the biggest challenges with networks and having the interoperation and distributed responsibilities with networks has been the difficulty in any one vendor or entity leading some change the world effort. So we don't want this to be a single vendor project. We would like to get other security vendors involved. We'd like to have good conversations with SOC analysts about what information they need when they're looking up specific behaviors, as well as with software makers to figure out what they can realistically provide about the behaviors of their software. And then with other security vendors, similar to ExtraHop, who would be using this data to figure out what they might need from such a system for them to be able to adopt it and get value from it. So those are the three primary stakeholders that we see. And we would like to have a community driving this that has all three groups represented.
Good, thank you.
Alan Friedman's done a lot of work on this. He's, I think, commerce under HHS or DHS. I can't remember where he is today. I mean, he's done a lot of the early legwork to kind of move this initiative forward. If you could leverage now the executive order, which creates the need for the SBOM and kind of mandates the SBOM, which is great. If you attach behaviors now to the SBOM, it becomes a natural extension, maybe without a regulatory requirement. Is that possible in kind of working across these different groups?
We actually had some great conversations with Alan. He's at the NTIA now and has been working quite a lot and ever since that executive order came out. So I hope that he's been getting enough sleep lately. The challenge we found when we talked to folks from Cyclone DX and talked to Alan was that the needs of behavior transparency around having a central clearinghouse really are at odds with some of the needs for SBOM. So SBOM's need for precision about the pieces of software that are in a particular thing kind of require, if not in-band distribution, at the very least direct distribution. There are too many minor variations of a particular thing to make those all publicly available and still have a manageable set of documents. So what Ben's been looking at has been the extraction of some of these data points from bills of material or Cisco manufacturer usage description documents so that behavior transparency can absorb and make public certain aspects of that without needing to make public things that organizations might not be willing to share with the world at large.
Got it. And it's also a little more out of band instead of being in band, and so direct as part of the actual build.
Right, because in band does raise the question in the case of like Sunburst, if I've compromised the CICD system to add my own bad code, can I also mess with the bill of materials so that it still looks legitimate?
Right.
Yeah, you know, so I was going to mention, like, the bill of materials, it can be really complicated and difficult to construct, but in a lot of cases, you can also have some automation around it, which again, sometimes is very, very difficult to get set up initially. But behaviors can be a little, it can be a lot even harder to pin down. Like, you might know that you're using libcurl, but you need to actually hunt through the code to see what you're using it for. Like, what is it? What are you using that library to contact? So that's another aspect of kind of where maybe, Ted mentioned Cyclone DX. They've got a services component in there that is, lines right up with, the behaviors that we're talking about. But they're somewhat orthogonal efforts.
Yeah. Adrian, did you have a question in there? Because I want to make sure I get to you before I ask last question.
Yeah. So I feel like one thing maybe worth talking about is ultimately I think the buyers have a big stake in this and they provide the financial incentive. So I think at some point here, we have to focus on educating the buyers so that they can put this in their SIG, or their RFP, or however they you know, leverage vendors to do the things that they, meet their individual requirements on what they need out of their products, out of their vendors' products.
Absolutely agree. I mean, it should at least be a convenience, going back to just firewall rules, instead of having to copy paste between, some website or some PDF or some other documentation. If you could just say can you please just supply, some behavior transparency, some JSON file that I can just upload into my firewall. So I can skip that step. It's less error prone. I completely agree.
The next iteration is SOAR. Plus, adding it to the SIG means now I have one additional question on top of the 1,400 already being asked in a SIG.
Light.
So.
SIG
yeah,
light.
What's one more? What's one more question, right?
Right. My last question, Ted and Ben, is if people are interested to get involved or learn more, where should they go? How do they get engaged?
So we've set up a form right now at extrahop.com/behavior-transparency that people should reach out to us, and we'll convene a follow-up meeting of those who are interested. So that will redirect you to a blog post that summarizes this, as well as a sign-up form. And this is going to go just to create that initial working group. So we're hoping that people will reach out that way. We're also both on Twitter, so please feel free to reach out there. And our next step here is going to be to try and get that group off the ground so that we have representation from each of the stakeholders.
That's great. Ted, Ben, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
To learn more about ExtraHop or how to support supply chain behavior transparency, please visit that URL, extrahop.com/behavior-transparency. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Stopping advanced threats requires knowing exactly what you're up against. ExtraHop Reveal X is the only solution that shows you not just where intruders are going, but where they've been. 90-day look back and complete network visibility across the data center, cloud, and device edge help security teams respond 84% faster with ExtraHop Reveal X network detection and response. Explore the interactive demo at securityweekly.com/extrahop. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque and Adrian Sanabria. Security Weekly is proud to announce that we will be at InfoSec World 2021 in person. Yes, our second in-person event, October 25th, 27th, 2021. This year, our annual partnership with InfoSec World is extra special as we are both business units under the Cyber Risk Alliance brand. What does that mean for Security Weekly listeners and InfoSec World attendees? You get to see and hear from many of the Security Weekly team at the event, and you will save 20% off your World Pass. Visit securityweekly.com/ISW2021 to register using our discount code. Do you want to stay in the loop on all things Security Weekly? Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher, our YouTube channel, sign up for the mailing list, join Discord, and follow us on our newest live streaming platform, Twitch. All right, gentlemen, articles of the week. As you know, Jason, having been both a CIO and a CISO, I pull in some CIO stories every once in a while because they have a lot of overlap with our CISO audience. And this first article is about CIO succession planning.
it's an important factor of leadership, no matter what department you're leading, right? Whether you're a CIO, you're a CFO, you're a CISO. At the end of the day, what I typically like to do with my teams is, you know, groom a few members of the team to kind of learn the day to day. So at the end of the day, you know, I tell them, your job is to put me out of a job, because when you put me out of a job, I'm moving on to my next best thing, right? So having that succession plan where you can, you know, you can actually give that leadership training, let's say, you know, have basically having a lieutenant that you can work with and really build them up to be a leader within your organization. That way you have a solid plan. If you go on to take a new role within your organization, you know, you don't have to spend. I think we're talking about industry right now. It takes 6 to 8 months to get a C-level executive, if you're lucky. You know, it's hard to fill those shoes. It's hard to fill in C-level executives, CIOs, CISOs. It takes a while. So, you know, it benefits the team. It gives leadership strategies and training to your staff. And, you know, it gives you a future-proof scenario where, you know, you can have that strategy where you're future-proofing your business unit.
Yeah, one of the
there's a bit of a hold my beer moment in this article here. And it says, I'm going to quote the article, CIOs have one of the shortest average tenures among the C-suite, with an average company stay of 4.6 years. CISOs be like.
Yeah. CISOs are like 18 months, right? Something like that.
Yeah, have that. Absolutely have right. That number. Yeah. But the trend in here that I thought was interesting, which isn't helping, is that more and more replacements are coming from the outside. To your point,
yes.
Take 6 to 8 months. If you have valid resources internally and you're preparing for this succession at some point and training up internally, it could lead to better internal candidates to move into those roles and not wait 6 to 8 months for that gap to be filled from the outside.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a huge benefit, because out of the gate, now you still have that institutional knowledge within the business unit, right? So yes, it takes 6 to 8 months just to hire. How long does it take for that CIO to ramp up and learn the business, right? So that could take another 6 months. That could take a year. So you know, building that type of a succession strategy is literally, I look at it like future-proofing your organization, because you're building a new leader. You're putting someone in a position where they could step into the role easily, and you're doing a service back to the business, back to customers, right? Because now you have someone who can jump in and take the role and really hit the ground running.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, we.
So what does that look like? Is that like a chief of staff role? You know, that person that you're kind of grooming for that position?
It could be anything, right? I mean, there's a reason why there are deputy CIOs now. There's a reason why there are deputy CISOs, deputy. Right? You know, I've seen some organization have the BSO, you know, where they have a business line security officer. Maybe one of those business line security officers are getting groomed to be a CISO, right? So I think you can really, you know, pick and choose how you want that org structure to be. But at the end of the day, you got to get it done. You got to do it, right? You got to start planning for that and really finding the folks within your organization who you know will grow into that role. I mean, a key piece of that is just, you know, being able to teach business strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, as a CISO or a CIO, you're going to become a translator to and from the business. So you're going to be translating cybersecurity, right? Or technology to other business units, to your board of directors, to your CEO, but then you have to take, you know, that business strategy back and translate it back to the team so you can execute.
Yeah, that's why that second point that's in this article around the business audience is so important. That's why I think the role of the BISO, the business information security officer, plays a very interesting role to bridge that gap if you do have to replace and allow them to move up. A chief of staff could as well, because they might be working across organizations, but having those folks in the business would definitely help with any transition of that kind of role change.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. This next article is, what is the hidden cost of technical debt? We've talked about tech debt a lot of times on this show. And some of the challenges around technical debt. This was an interesting article because it tries to map out where some of those hidden costs are and where they're going to bite you later. What was it? The Cisco survey that they did at RSA conference, talking about one of the biggest ways to reduce your overall risk footprint was constant turnover and upgrade of your systems, right? Eliminating
tech refresh.
Debt. Right. Yep. Tech refresh was a big one. So this outlines some of these kind of hidden costs that people don't think about when it comes to tech debt.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much there, right? When you're talking about legacy systems, end of life, end of support systems that you're trying to keep together with bubblegum and duct tape, right? I've seen that so many times, you know, at customers and, you know, they end up running into an issue. That's why they bring in a technology services organization. And, you know, yes, security is a big piece of it, but when you start looking at the bigger, broader picture, operational efficiencies, staff overhead to manage these systems, right? Revenue opportunity loss because you're not bringing the latest, greatest technologies to your customers, right? And reaping the benefits of the value add that brings to the table and maybe the efficiencies or, streamlined process that brings to the table. So there's a lot there, a lot of overhead that comes with managing these legacy systems.
Curious, Jason, if you, this is a topic I've actually been chatting about a lot, just the age of assets and using that as like a KPI or KRI metric. Should people be setting, the date for things to be replaced, the actual expected lifetime of a system before they even deploy it
I think that's part of managing your CMDB, right? Part of managing your asset database and your CMDB is putting in that expected life cycle of that asset, right? And being able to track things like manufacturer maintenance dates, manufacturer end of life dates. So you can start targeting those timeframes to be able to do the right budgeting and financial planning to replace them. You know, it has to be a structured program where you're going through and you're saying, all right, here's the refresh cycle for these type of assets that have, this expected shelf life. Because at the end of the day, you want that to be a proactive budgeting process, not a reactive budgeting process. I want to be able to go to my CFO and say, hey, while I'm doing the budget next year, I have all of these assets coming up. We have to plan for that and we have to budget for that. So that's why I need this in my budget, this amount of money, right? And be able to have those good conversations and proactive conversations about budgeting, because at the end of the day, you're going to need the financials to do that.
Yep. And opportunity loss in the ability not to make up for some of that on the revenue side also hampers that discussion.
Absolutely.
When you're dealing with the P&L.
100%. And security is not on this list, interestingly. You could have put that on the top five.
Absolutely. 100%. 100% could be in the top five. And that was kind of my opening statement. Security obviously is a big deal, but there's all of these other, right? All of these other costs as well. And when you combine that conversation together and you say, here's the business risk that we're having from a security compliance perspective, along with all of these other business cases you can bring to the table, that's when you bring a full package for investment to the CFO to get money, right? That's how you have that conversation.
And again, we're talking about business impact and business costs as part of the security discussion. And that's it's not a separate discussion per se.
That's right.
Yeah. This next article actually digs into the technical debt challenges, how to manage some of that. And what I thought was interesting is kind of what is driving tech debt. So the two things that popped up right away are mismatched code and staff turnover. Mismatched code means I got a lot of different code bases because of the legacy. I got stuff written in C, C++, and all the way through all these different languages. That coupled with staff turnover and the gap in some of the skill sets is what's fueling aspects of this tech debt.
That's right. That's right. And many organizations feel stuck. You know, they feel stuck in a place that they you can drown in technical debt. And to be honest with you, we say it all the time here, no action is still an action. So you don't want to let yourself drown in that technical debt. And if you feel as an organization, you really don't know where to go, find a partner, find someone who can help you, right? Because the quicker you can start getting out from under that technical debt, the better off your organization is going to be. So, go find a business partner who can help guide you through a roadmap to start migrating, out of that technical debt.
Yep. Agreed. The 10 leadership habits to master. Good list. I thought it was a really good way to kind of lay out some of these top habits from a leadership perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, they, you know, as Paul and I have been integrating in with Cyber Risk Alliance, this is a lot of the foundational stuff we've had to do over the past number of months. Right. So I thought it was fun to kind of have them listed out here all in front of us in a single article.
Yep. No, it's a great list. I mean, you know, we've talked about it on the show a few times, you know, a lot of these, and I really believe, you know, having that level of communication with your team and with the business on your vision. So those top two, one and two, I think are super, super important, right? Because, you know, the organization needs to know where we're driving toward, and you need to be in constant communication with them. So that way everybody's on the same page, right? So those are the two biggies for me. You know, define your vision, make sure the teams know where you're headed, why you're headed there, and how we're going to get there together. And then constant communication and transparency with the teams.
Yeah.
And number two is kind of a prerequisite for a lot on there.
Yeah. Agreed. I want to double tap in on number five, document every process, because this is one of the investments Paul and I made from the podcast side very early on when I came over, which was to have our processes document. Paul and I are big believers that over time we can, if you optimize process, you change the scale of the organization. You also change the resource needs of the organization. Can't do everything manually. But to automate, you need good documentation. So we've spent the time to do that. We're now doing that through the rest of Cyber Risk Alliance in documenting all of our processes, because how else do you scale? How else do you get away from all the manual requirements if you don't have a good starting point for what those processes look like?
Absolutely, 100% dead on. I mean, you know, I started getting involved in lean business process mapping a long time ago. You know, when I first started running my first IT department, I realized really quickly that a crappy process, you can throw any shiny technology on top of it, it's still going to be a crappy process and a crappy experience for the end users, right? And the people getting that service. So you have to dig into process. You have to document it. And it's not just documenting. It's always reviewing and continuously improving it. You have to review the process constantly and figure out where non-value add lives, and try to rip that non-value add out of the process, whether it's through automation, elimination, whatever the case may be. You always have to focus on continuously improving those processes. So a review cycle for those processes is important as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way to scale without continually optimizing process.
Right.
Otherwise, this is a huge cost burden to the organization because you got to scale it with people, and it doesn't work.
Right.
Also, the other one that I think a lot of leaders, some leaders have a challenge with is number eight, delegate, right? The ability to delegate to your staff to step up and take ownership instead of you needing to do everything. That's another big one I see with leaders.
Big time. Yeah, you have to let go, right? I mean, I always say once you get into a leadership position in IT or in security, you have to start thinking about taking your hands off a keyboard, right? At the end of the day, because now you're leading teams to be successful, and you hire folks for a reason, right? You don't hire folks so you have to micromanage them and be on top of them every day. You're hiring folks to go get a job done for you, right? You're the leader of that organization, and you're hiring for the skill sets that you need. Give the folks runway to go win, right? And go out there and win the game.
Yeah. And then if they run into an issue, figure out how to solve it for them, move them forward. That's number 10. And number 9, which we love, is create a healthy culture, which is what we've done here at Security Weekly. And it's starting to trickle across the rest of CRA.
I love it. Beautiful thing. Yep. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Number 6 is a personal passion of mine. You know, any new job I go to, I usually send out a link to Jason Fried's TED Talk, Why Work Doesn't Happen at Work.
Yeah.
And one of the big things I learned from that, like I remember him saying, look, if you got 14 people in a 1 hour meeting, it's not a 1 hour meeting, it's a 14 hour meeting.
Yep.
Meaning like, look at it like a consultant, you know, like what's the amount of productivity? Like was that 1 hour meeting with 14 people in it really worth 14 productivity hours?
Right.
Right. We're changing that internally as well. So
it's one of the hardest ones because that is part of the culture, you know? I mean, it was really weird going to Thinkst, because that's a company that doesn't really use email internally and doesn't really have meetings. You know, I mean, they'll set up an ad hoc meeting if they need it, you know, but almost everything was just through Slack, and it took a while to get used to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because without those regular meetings, you know, you start to think, well, you know, how do I know what's going on, you know, and you know, there are other ways to do that. You know, you don't need an hour meeting. And that's one of the other things Jason Fried jumps into is like, what's it called? Parkinson's law. So the amount of time that you give something, like the work will expand to fill that time. Mm-hmm. Like, what if it could be a 5-minute meeting?
Yeah.
Like, what if you just made the meeting 5 minutes and got done what you needed to get done in that 5 minutes because you set that constraint that small?
Yeah. I started doing something similar where I don't do hour meetings anymore. Half an hour is my limit. And I'm trying to start getting used to doing like 15 minute meetings. Right. Yeah. And see how that works. So we'll see, right. We'll see if it's successful, but you're absolutely right. Why have a meeting for the sake of a meeting, and why make it an hour if it can be done in 20 minutes?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to go to 30 minute meetings for everything. I try to minimize how many of those I have in a week. Right. So like my new team, it's a half an hour meeting once a week. That's it. Everything else is done through communicators, right? Teams, Slack, whatever.
Yep.
We still have a few 1 hour meetings, like the ops meeting, because we got so much to cover. That's kind of the exception to the rule, but I try to keep them to half an hour or less now.
Yeah.
Let's see. Article number 5, how to build a strong crisis communications team. Lots of ransomware in the news, folks. Guess what? Crisis is coming. This article, you know, kind of gives you a little guide on making sure you're assigning the right roles and responsibilities and how to craft a better crisis team. It's a good starting point. I think it's missing some details that I think would be a good follow-up article, but it is a good primer.
Yeah. It's funny how you learn things over time, right? And I really cut my teeth in IT leadership in government, in the public sector, right? And I thank God all the time just for my interactions that I had with the emergency management agency, because they taught me a level of incident response based on EMA level crisis, right? And having that background only helped me on the security side, right? Being able to manage an incident like you were going through an EMA type course, right? Where you have everything predefined, you know all your stakeholders, people have roles and actions that they play as part of the response process. Everything is very process oriented, like we were talking about before, right? It's funny how you learn things from other disciplines, but EMA strategies around crisis management are outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you assign the right roles, you delegate. We just talked about delegation from a leadership perspective. Then you communicate in smaller teams so each group has their own components to manage. Way more efficient than what we were just talking about, the big meeting, right? What are you going to do? Bring everybody in and just leave them on for 24 hours straight to deal with the crisis? Not very efficient.
Right. Yeah, I think the other side of this is you know, the PR piece of crisis communications is so important. You know, the timing is important. You know, I've seen so many companies go through identical situations and one comes out, you know, relatively smelling like a rose, you know, and the other one has just done so much more damage than the attack did, you know, just by handling it badly, you know, by coming out and saying, no, it's not happening, you know, denying it, you know, and then not getting information out. Like I remember when Sony Pictures got hit, you actually had Sony Pictures employees emailing journalists because journalists had access to the data asking, is my data in the leak? You know, because they couldn't get anything from their employer.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why, you know, the planning piece to be able to have a very strong communications plan. And believe me, that's a collaboration effort right there, right? You develop the communications plan with your you know, legal team, with your HR team, with your finance team, because there are aspects to all of the communications that affect all of those different stakeholders. And you want to make sure that you know you have a really, really structured communication plan and how you're going to deliver that information over time. It's got to be planned. You have to train the way you fight, right?
Yeah, like Buffer, for example, had one of their best sales days ever just because people were so impressed with how they handled their breach.
Right, right.
Yep.
And it's not, you can't just step into it on a whim, right, and do a good job. You just can't.
Nope. Planning.
You have to plan for these things.
Yeah. Yep.
Got to plan it. Got to be prepared. Last article, 5 ingredients to finding satisfaction and fulfillment in your work. Can anybody guess which one is my gap?
Which one's your gap?
My gap.
Know when to work and when not to work.
Balance. You balance? Guessed it, baby.
You know why? Do you know why I picked that for you? Because it's the same one for me. That's all I did. Yep. I picked mine and I knew it'd be yours.
Yep. Number 4 is easy.
Yeah. I mean, some of these are easy, right? But I mean, I thought it was a good list as a starting point. Look, if you're coming back into the workforce or you're looking to change jobs, I think this is a really good guideline to kind of direct, you know, what do I want out of a company when I go into a company, right? My biggest challenge, I know the why, I know what we do, I know why we do it, I know why I'm here. I don't have to worry about that. My problem has always been balance, knowing when to stop working, yep, because otherwise I get it from the wife.
Same here. Same here. You yelled that from the wife and kids. But no, I mean, you know, to take the 30,000 foot view on this, you know, you gotta be, it's a mutual relationship between the employer and the employee, right? And culturally it has to be a good fit, right? Sometimes organizations aren't a good fit for me, and sometimes I may not be a good fit for the organization, right? And you just gotta be able to look at it and realize when the fit is there, right? So knowing who you're working for and knowing what their vision is and why you're doing the work is important. So that way, you know, you're aligned to it or you're not.
Right. And to me, when one of these falls out of place, except for balance for me, but when some of the other ones fall out of balance, that's when you start looking, right?
Yep.
When the meaning is gone or when the direction is wrong, that's when people start to look. That's why I said this is a really good 5 kind of things to look at to make sure, you know, you're aligned with the company you're working for or the company you're getting ready to work for.
Yeah. And I look at these at, you know, when I look at metrics, I look at 2 different kind of indicators, right? Lead indicators and lag indicators. These are really good lead indicators, right? Lead indicators to show that maybe, you know, the alignment between you and the employer is no longer there. That way it doesn't go down the rabbit hole for too long. Do you know what I mean? So you start looking at these as lead indicators to really give you metrics on whether or not the compatibility is still there, I'll put it.
Yep. Agreed.
And number 2 and number 4, I think, are interesting. Those are ones, you know, when I chat with people, you know, that are a little bit earlier in their career or I'm mentoring people, you know, at some point, you know, you just got to get experience and you can't afford to be too picky, you know, but I think it was about 12 years into my career before I really started to think about number 2 and number 4, you know, why am I working? Why am I doing this? You know, do I want to switch industries? You know, is this what I want to keep doing for the rest of my life? And then also, you know, it's at that point, it becomes about more than a paycheck. Once you have some options and things like that, you know, you gotta get some enjoyment and satisfaction out of it. And that's one thing, reflecting on my first gig, which was a large credit card processor, large financial company, that pretty much guaranteed I could never go back that route again, because job satisfaction would happen maybe once every 3 years or something like that. And I know for me, for the way I work, that, you know, I've got to be creating stuff. I've got to be turning stuff out. I've got to be getting feedback on it. You know, like I personally have that need, you know, and I remember interviewing for a large bank and asking them, you know, how long their average project was. And they're like, 3 to 5 years. I'm going to lose my mind. I cannot do that. And it's funny because the hiring manager, Like, he contacted me, he's like, you know, cause I was talking to some of his direct reports, and he was like, yeah, it seemed like, you know, the interview didn't go too well. And, you know, effectively I threw it. I was like, no, this is not something I want to do. And he was like, I want you to interview with someone else next. And, he's a good friend of mine now. But yeah, I told him, no, it's just not, you know, this is not an environment that I can be happy in.
Yeah.
Number two and number four are reasons I've left employers, and also part of the reason why I ended up at Security Weekly way back in the day. So yes, they are important factors as well, for sure. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. It's always a pleasure. Thank you everyone for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.